The human heart cannot exist without gratitude. Bar none, it is the central of all virtues as far as a human being what he is intended to be, made in the image of God. Without gratitude, the human heart becomes a stone and a rock. Oh, it's a stone and a rock that'll still pump some blood and still beat, but it's not what it ought to be. If I had only one virtue, if I were told only one virtue that I could teach my grandchildren, the one thing I would want them to be able to have is gratitude. I believe gratitude is far more than learning to say, you know, after a parent, and what do we say? You know, it's the part where the water actually flows out of a heart to say, I understand and I'm grateful. Gratitude is far more than this. It's the lotion that keeps the heart soft and pliable and moldable. But more than that, gratitude is the evidence that the light of truth has been in the heart. There will be darkness of selfishness and darkness of self-centeredness in every human heart. But when you find honest gratitude, it meant that the light has gotten in the dark places and begins to dispel it. Gratitude's essential. I've told this story before, and many of you will remember portions of it. But I can tell you the hinge that my life swung on as far as the family I came from. I can't articulate it as well as I wished I could. I can tell you part of the incidents very objectively, but there's a point in time, the story I'm about to tell you, it breaks down, and I cannot put in words what this story means to me. It's one of the most profound incidents in all my life. When I was a little kid, my dad was a truck driver for Safeway, and we were in Kansas City, but Dad wanted to get out of Kansas City, and many of you know this part, so I'll make it fast, but so Dad pulled junk machinery out of fence rows and started farming back in the little towns of Milford and Jericho Springs and Lamar, that area. Dad would get up in the morning and he would go to work for Walt Sharp and milk cows, and he would milk from about 4 to about 6 or 6:30. Dad would then go to the Case dealership and work as a mechanic, kind of a roustabout at the Case dealership in Lamar. And then when he was through work at the Case dealership, Dad would go home and stop at Walt Sharp's again and milk cows for a couple of hours. Get home around 7, 7:30, something like that. Mom would meet him with a little supper, and we'd set maybe the tailgate of a pickup or something, and Dad would have supper with us. He would take me and put me on his lap and get on a tractor. He said I could normally make one or two rounds on a tractor, and I was sound asleep, and he'd stop and hand me over the tire of the tractor to Mom, and then Dad would farm from whatever time that was till midnight, maybe 12:30, and Dad would come home and try to sleep 3 hours or 4 hours and get up and go milk cows for Walt Sharp, and that's how we got by. Everybody's story is different, and mine's no more unique than anybody else's story. Mine just happens to be my story, but that's all it is. Financially, it was really, really tough, and I know that. I mean, I didn't feel the pressure as a kid. I didn't feel that at all. But had my grandmother not run a grocery store, so Dad ran up a tab all winter long and could hardly pay. In the fall, he would sell the bean crop or whatever it was and pay the tab off, and we'd start the next winter running over with a tab on Grandma's grocery store again. I tell you all that to tell you that I was probably 8 years old. We left on a vacation, the first trip we'd ever taken. It was a one-day trip. It took 3 days to get there. We went all the way from Lamar, Missouri, to a great big metropolis, Springfield, Missouri. You ought to go there sometime. I'm telling you what. Springfield, it's not called the Queen City for nothing, I'm telling you. We got up that morning, and I'm telling you, that was the longest car ride I ever imagined. I mean, you just humongous. You went forever and miles, and we went to the Shrine Circus in Springfield. went to the Serine Circus, and we went in, and we all there were three of us of knowledgeable age, and there's myself and my sister, who's 2 years younger, Gwen, and then my sister, or my brother. He hates being called my sister. He's got this little quirk about that. I don't know what there is. But anyhow, my brother Dennis, who's 2 years younger than Gwen, and then our youngest brother, the last one, Doug. And so Doug would have been just a little bitty kid. We went into the Serine Circus, and Dad gave us each 35 cents to get something. And again, I'm 8 years old, and a pirate's sword caught my attention on one of those carts that they have with all kinds of souvenirs on it. And so we went in, and I got a pirate sword. You can't beat a good black pirate sword. You know, you can whack folks and all kinds of stuff. It's a great gift. But we're in the middle of the Serine Circus, and I look over, and my brother, who's 4 years younger than I am, he got a helium balloon. Well, what's the good of being the older brother if you can't take it away? And so I don't remember even a great deal of problem over it, other than I took his helium balloon from him. He wasn't excited about that, but he is a pretty laid-back kid, and it wasn't horrible, you know, but I got his helium balloon. So I'm playing with his helium balloon, and you know what helium balloons don't you? I mean, you're pretty comfortable in what's going to take place in a great big high auditorium, aren't you? I mean, you've kind of got me, you know, figured out on this one. Sure enough, I fumble the string somehow, and this helium balloon shoots to the ceiling. Now, at that point in time, Dennis was not overly happy about it, and he began to cry. At that point in time, I can tell you objectively what's happened. This is where I have to step out of the picture and say, I can't explain it. I began to weep. I began to weep in ways that are deeper and more profound than I can begin to explain to you. I don't think anybody else sitting around me, I've always embarrassed pretty easy, so I don't think anybody in front of me or behind me would have known it, but I was weeping uncontrollably. My dad gave me a look, because he had seen the end result. Dennis tattled on me. And Dad gave me a look, but that wasn't the reason for the weeping. But I'm weeping hard enough that my mom sees it now finally. Mom looks at Dad like, what did you do to the boy? And Dad's going, I didn't do anything. I mean, Dad's claiming innocence. And I am absolutely devastated. And I can tell you, I cried there. I cried most of the way home. And when we got home, I still couldn't put it into words. My folks are trying to figure out how to get me to talk. You didn't send kids to a counselor back in those days. You sent them to grandma, you know, or something. But, I mean, they're thinking, what is wrong with the guy? And I couldn't express it. It just wouldn't come. After we'd been home a couple of hours, the dam broke, and I verbalized. And what I verbalized, I mean, I'm 52 years old, but what I verbalized to this day, it is as if it were yesterday. Something occurred in that moment at the Serine Circus where suddenly, for the first time, I saw my father's sacrifice. I saw what it looked like for a man to get up at 4 a.m. and get in the truck and head out. For the first time, I understood what it was like to be on my dad's lap in fields. For the first time, I understood the depths of my father's love, and I understood a second part. I understood how ungrateful and selfish I was. I had just taken 35 cents of my dad's money, and how much money means nothing. But I had taken 35 cents of it and thrown it away, and suddenly a picture of an incredible love and a very ungrateful son who had never gotten it before. And all I remember is saying to my family that day, I'm so sorry I never understood how much you loved us. And I'm sorry I've never lived up to the kind of gratitude I should have had. My birth certificate doesn't really tell the truth. My birth certificate says that on May the 21st of 1954, I was born to Bob and Fontella Garris. The truth is, on a late April day, In 1962, I became my father's son. It was the day the hinge turned and the day gratitude turned a light on in my life, and I finally understood something. There are moments that occur in everybody's life where they get it, where suddenly the light of truth comes on. I was at a little conference a week and a half ago. I was speaking at the JARS headquarters in North Carolina. David Wearsby was on the same platform. David Wearsby is Warren Wearsby's son. David Wearsby was speaking, and he told a story, and I know where the story came from. In fact, I've seen the same one. But David Wearsby told the story of a woman who tells the story of her own childhood. She said, "I was just a baby, and I was in the crib, and the house fire broke out. And when the house fire broke out, my mom fought her way into the bedroom and grabbed me and got me. But it was in those days and where they didn't worry quite as much about what things were, and we just invented some new synthetic materials. And remember some of the blankets from the olden days that if you lit a fire to them? And basically said, Mom got me, and she put me under one arm, but this blanket catches on fire, and every part of flesh it touched, it just welded itself to it. And said, my mom carries me out with this blanket welded to her hands as she's got me tucked. And she said, I remember as a little bitty girl being afraid of my mom's hands. They were webbed between the fingers, and they were scarred hands. She said, as a little girl, just being afraid of them. And she said, I'm not talking about a teenage years or even junior high years kinds of things. She said, I'm talking about being a little bitty girl. She said, I remember being one time or two ashamed of my mom's hands because everybody's head would turn and you just saw mom's hands. And she said, I remember having a little bit of embarrassment about it. Until I knew the full story. And she said, when I knew the full story about my mom's hands, now what David didn't go ahead and tell, and where I have seen it as well, the lady finishes her testimony. She said, when my mom passed away, she said, I will tell you, one of the most profoundly moving moments was when I, as the last thing I did, was place my mom's hands in the casket the way I wanted them to be placed. Because the hands symbolized a life of sacrifice, and those hands and the scars they bore. I say all of that to set up this. It's the same text Chris DeWelt showed you a minute ago. We are in the book of Isaiah. We're going to end up in the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. I will tell you right now, it is the truth of that text is the hinge that your life turns on, if you get it. If you don't get the concept, then passages like Isaiah 53 will mean nothing to you. But if you get it, it is as profound as that day that I had in my father's house. It is as profound as a mother having her hands tucked away inside of his casket. This text is profound. We will start a little earlier. Now, I'll put it on the screen, or I'll say I'll put it on the screen. That word "I'll" is pretty much of a lie. They'll put it on the screen. But we'll walk our way through it till we get to Isaiah chapter 53. The book of Isaiah is the Old Testament gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, you know the New Testament gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. Those are the eyewitness accounts of Jesus. The book of Isaiah is the Old Testament equivalent. Now, it's a sonogram. I mean, it's the one who's coming. Now, you know a sonogram's a little fuzzy. I don't think we've even said it publicly back here. Katie's pregnant, and so she'll have a sonogram, and this will be our grandchild. Don't know yet it's a little boy or a little girl, but I'm telling you right now it's a fuzzy image on this sonogram. I promise you. It's a little hard to know for sure what we're looking at. You wouldn't automatically recognize the child later going, well, of course that's you. I saw your sonogram. It won't happen. But Isaiah has a little of that blurriness, but there's not a mama here who hadn't held up a sonogram and realized, this is my child. This is life. So too, Isaiah holds it up and says, this is your life. This is your king. Let me show you his picture. And so you have in the book of Isaiah. Let's just walk our way through some of the passages. You've done this in the last couple of weeks. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. It's the rather classic one. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign, and the virgin will be with child, and will give birth to a son. And you call his name Emmanuel, God with us. You move to the next passage, Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he'll be called Wonderful Counselor and Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and peace, of being, nobody's going to stop his kingdom, by the way. Nobody's going to stop it. You think you've seen kings, they rise and fall like dominoes play on a table. But when this king comes, there will not be any stopping of this kingdom. He'll reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness. And from that time on and forever, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. You're going to go to Isaiah chapter 11. In Isaiah chapter 11, it says, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. Now, again, that's prophetic. Jesse is David's father, King David. It's his father. Jesse, the house of David, had been told the Messiah will come from you. But the reason it's called a stump is it looked like that tree was gone. There's nothing there. That tree's dead. Nothing's coming from that tree anymore. Everything is gone. That's just an old stump. Too many generations have gone by. Nothing's coming out of David's family now. But a shoot will come out from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord God will be on him, the Lord will be on him, and the Spirit of wisdom and understanding. And he goes on. I'm not going to go through the whole text. They're just pictures through Isaiah. This is the sonogram again of Jesus. Isaiah 53 is the text I want you to go to. In Isaiah 53, we will put it on the screen for you. But let me just tell you the process. This is going to be an incredibly simple sermon. And yet, I'm going to tell you, this week on working on this sermon, you have one deeply moved preacher this morning. I want to say this carefully. I went through the text and tried to do it as carefully as I could. I went back and labored through the Greek translation of it, coming through the Septuagint. I can kind of do that. I had to use aids all the way, but I went through the Hebrew, and I tried to take it Hebrew and work my way through it. And there's some powerful concepts in here. Words, you go, wow, that word really. But let me tell you what actually gripped me the most was when in my own journaling, I paraphrased each verse and put it in my own words. And it was in the process of just writing out my own paraphrase. Will it impact you the same way? No, no. You see, it's like anything else. It's my investment in it. It's what moved me. You'd have to go home this afternoon and write your own paraphrase. But I'll tell you right now, you go home and labor through this, and you write out in your own words. It's like the Shrine Circus Day, gang. There's a truth, this hinge swings. Isaiah, we're going to put the real verse up on the screen, and I'll give you my paraphrase, and let's just walk our way through it. Isaiah 53, verse 1. Who can believe what I'm about to tell you? An astonishing tale. It's an astounding thing that you'll see what God is about to do. The Hebrew word, by the way, and the word for arm is also the Hebrew word for seed. The Hebrew word for seed and the word for arm. What causes a seed to grow? They didn't know. All they knew is God made things to grow. The arm of God, the seed and the arm are similar concepts in the Hebrew. In fact, this probably is a prophecy that comes out of the book of Genesis that from the seed of woman will come. He uses that Hebrew word seed. But in this text, he says, let me tell you, it's an astounding thing God is about to do. Verse 2, he... This is going to be a story of a person. This is a story not of a plan or a strategy or a theology. It's much more personal than that. When you see what God's going to do, it's going to be a he. There's a person who's going to be at the core of what God does. Verse 2, he will be an unexpected thing, like a tender plant coming out of a dry land. You look at this desert, and there's nothing in the desert and nothing to cause you to believe anything's going to happen. And suddenly a tender, fragile plant comes out of dry land. And you won't be astonished when you first see him, He has no celebrity persona, no movie star looks, no kingly features like power, wealth, influential family, nothing to magnetically draw you to him. That's probably true about Jesus' whole life. I mean, he's born of Joseph and Mary. He comes out of Nazareth. He's just a carpenter's son. I mean, all of that. But it's probably less about his whole life and probably more cross-centered than anything else. Verse 3, in fact, just the opposite. You'll look on him in despised ways. You'll reject him and want to have nothing to do with him. In fact, when you see who he is and what he does, you'll turn your face away from him in disgust and go, yuck, you'll turn your face. He'll be a man well acquainted with sorrow, and he'll know grief very, very well. Verse 4, but it will be your grief he carries. It'll be our sorrow on his shoulders. But being ignorant that it's your grief he carries and our sorrows on his shoulders, being ignorant of that, you'll think he's being crushed and judged by God himself for something he himself is. Verse 5. But it's on account of my transgressions he is wounded. For my sins he is so bruised. And the punishment he receives is to make peace for me. And the stripes and scars on his body, they are for the sake of my healing. Verse 6. We like sheep have gone so far astray. Every one of us has turned to his own selfish way. And the sins of all of us for that, our sins the Lord has placed on his shoulders. There are three views of Christmas. The three basic views of Christmas are these. For many people, it's nothing. I mean, it's just a bunch of religious tripe. It's just sort of one of the gimmicks the world sees, either businesses or churches or whatever putting together. But it's, for many people, it would be nothing. But for the vast majority of people, Christmas is probably the second one. It's sort of a nostalgic, sentimental kind of, hey, gang, we're a community of people who sort of need each other. It's about a baby coming to the world, an innocent baby coming into a very bad world in a very bad way. And it's just a reminder that, gang, we have innocent people around us and we need to take better care of one another. Let's take cookies to the neighbors and let's sing together around a tree and sing kumbaya and let's be nicer people to one another. No, there's nothing wrong with some of that element of let's be nicer to one another. It's kind of a be nice holiday because it reminds you of an innocent day gone by. That's probably the biggest majority. But you need to know the third view, the biblical view of Christ's coming, is never about being nice to one another. The biblical view of Christ's coming is centered on a very specific issue. It is God coming in the flesh to die for you. It is very, very specific about the one who comes to die. Yesterday, at Seth Wilson's memorial service, Dave Shepler made this comment. He said, every other baby basically is born in life to live. And then death sort of catches them and gets them. But the purpose in life of a baby is to live. This is the one baby born in the world who came to die. Philippians chapter 2, God emptied himself and took the form of a servant and came in human flesh. Why? This text. Verse 7. He is mistreated and harshly abused, yet not one word from him in his own defense. Like a lamb silent on the way to the slaughterhouse, like a sheep without a sound before the shearer, not one word from him to stop it. Verse 8. He's unjustly condemned. He's led away. No one cared that his life was cut so short. No one cared that he died without the descendants. But he was struck down for the rebellion of his people. Verse 9. They killed him with criminals, and they put him in the place of a rich man. Man, you talk about specific prophecies. Wow. I mean, that is a phenomenal prophecy. 700 years before it occurs. When you see him die, there'll be criminals around him. And in his death, look for a rich man's place. And he is crucified with criminals on the left and right. And they take him off and they put him in a rich man's tomb. Verse 9, he was never violent, and there was never anything but integrity. Verse 10, here's an odd twist. Yet it was the Lord who did these things to him. The New Testament passage is, his life wasn't taken from him, he laid it down. This is not about Jews crucifying Jesus. This isn't about Romans crucifying Jesus. And anybody who ever shakes their fist at the Jews and calls them some kind of Christ killers, which has occurred in the past, that is crazy. The text says it this way, very clear. It was God. It was the Lord who did these things to him. God bruised him. God brought him this grief. For he made his soul an offering for sin. And that's where the divergent paths really hit. There are two views on Christianity at that point in time. I mean, that's ultimately, when you come to Christianity, you got to go one way or the other. One way you go is, goes, wow, this is malarkey. He made his soul an offering for sin. You guys are a bunch of chicken littles crying the sky is falling. Only instead of saying the sky's fallen, you're saying you guys have sin problems, sin problems. You have sin problems. You invent a crisis, sin problems. And then you try to gather the whole world because we got sin problems. And you try to gather them to your faith and your church and your group. And you say sin problems. Those aren't the real problems in life. The real problems in life is how do you pay Tuesday's mortgage? The real problems in life are, what do you do with this lump that may be malignant or could be benign? What do you do with the real problems in life? They're cutting back the rainforest and our oxygen's quitting. Real problems in life. There's global warming and we're going to live in a place where our kids don't want to be. Those are the real problems. And you chicken littles out there are crying out, sin problem, sin problem. I have no use for that nonsense. But the other road is not as popular. But it's for the person who decides Tuesday's mortgage is not my biggest problem. It's the person who decides what the world claims is the real issues, they've missed it. It's, why do I live this way with my wife and my children? Why, even when I say, I'm going to do good, why when I'm at work do I come home and drive home and go, what is wrong in me? It's the individual who stands there and goes, looking at their own baby and going, I may have participated in the formation of this child, but a man and a woman can't make a child. And where do the stars come from? And how does this work? And where's, and if I have a creator, and if this baby has a creator, what's he told me about himself? And if he's holy, I'm in trouble. And so when Jesus came in the flesh, the prostitutes and the tax gatherers went running to him. Because the tax collectors and prostitutes decided their biggest problem wasn't Tuesday's mortgage. And there comes a place and time in everybody's life that you have to decide, what are you going to do with this matter of sin? And he made his soul an offering for my sin. It finishes up, I'll go briefly, and he'll have many descendants. Wait a second, you said he wouldn't have any. Now you say he'll have many. He will enjoy a long life. Wait a second, you said his life would be cut short. What's this odd twist? And what he has done will be greatly blessed by God. Verse 11, and when he sees that all is accomplished by his anguish, he'll be content. What? For this righteous servant will make it possible for you to be counted among the righteous. Wow, what an incredible concept. You mean this substitution in my place, God himself, both wonderful in his justice, but wonderful in his mercy, I'll take your place that I might be counted among the righteous, for he bore your sins. Verse 12, the God who condemned will also exalt and lift him up. He is triumphant. That next phrase in this verse 12 is a conquering warrior. Who divides up spoils? It's the winning warrior. He is triumphant like a conquering warrior after a battle. The captured spoils are his because he poured his life out into death, because he identified himself with sinners, because he carried our sin, because he interceded for me. I was at a little get-together on Friday night with Van Benson. Van Benson told the story of his own father. He said, my father was 54 years old and not a Christian. He said, it was a Saturday evening and we were having a discussion. And he said, my father blew up. Now, again, Van can tell the story better than I can, but basically the dad said, I am sick and tired of hearing about this Jesus and you guys shoving him at me. I am sick and tired of it. I've had it up to here. I don't want to hear any more about your Jesus. I don't want to hear any more about how I need Jesus. I don't want to hear any more about how Jesus is the answer for my life. I don't want to hear one more invitation to your church. I don't want to hear one more thing. Do you understand me? I am sick and tired of your Jesus. And he said it was an explosion. I'm through with this. I don't tell me one more time about your Jesus. I am done. Van said when the explosion was over, and by the way, bless Van's stubborn heart, Van said to his dad something to this effect, Dad, I will honor your request if you'll do me a favor. His dad said, what is it? He said, Dad, I will honor what you ask if you'll do this. Would you go with me to church in the morning? Would you hold on your lap a Bible? And would you read the text that the sermon comes from? Would you read the Bible on your lap? Will you listen to the sermon? And when that's over, they sing what's called an invitation hymn. And Dad, if you still feel the same way, when that invitation hymn is sung, you can get up and walk out the back door. And I'll honor what you ask. But Dad, if you see what I think you'll see, at that invitation's also you get a choice. You can come forward and you can ask this Jesus to be in your life too. He said, Dad didn't give any answer. He didn't know what was going to take place. But the next morning his dad was dressed in his house. And they went to church. I'm confident on the way Van was playing, oh, don't let the sermon be on tithing. Don't let the sermon be on tithing. They got to church, and when they got to church, said Dad put a Bible on his lap, and he listened to the sermon. He said, I couldn't, see, looking. But he said, when the invitation hymn was sung, my dad got out and stepped in front of me. My father did not walk out the back door. My father turned and went to the front and knelt down and began to weep. And we gathered around him. And my father that day began to say, my whole life I have tried to shut him away. My whole life I've tried to say I didn't need him. And my whole life I've tried to say this is not what I needed in my life. And my whole life I've been wrong. He told that story to say that his dad, who's now in his 80s and he's a musician, his dad in his 80s made an album. That album is, his dad plays a beautiful trumpet. That album, Van said, you got to get on the internet and listen to my dad's CD. So I did that yesterday morning. The next to the last song is his dad talking. It's his dad's testimony of being an 80-some-year-old man and how he owed everything in his life that mattered ultimately to Christ. And this Jesus I wished I'd have come to sooner, and this Jesus I needed. And he said, there's a song I'd like to do. And that song, many of you know, is entitled My Tribute. It starts off with, how can I say thanks for all the things you've done for me? Things so undeserved, yet you gave. Gratitude is the essential trait of the human heart. It was a Shrine Circus in 1962. I became my father's son. It's out of passages like this. I'm a 52-year-old man, and no greater grace have I ever been given in all my life than that my God loved me and pursued me to the point of his own death, that I might be counted among the righteous.